It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The votes are in and almost completely tallied up after yesterday's midterm election. We're going to explore what the results mean for our region, our state, and for Washington throughout today's program with a half dozen experts, including Dana Brown, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women and Politics at Chatham University. Welcome, Dana.
Good morning.
Mike Warshagen is investigative reporter for the Caucus, which covers state government and politics. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Kevin.
And also in studio is Chris Potter, the editor of WESA's Politics and Government Accountability Team. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
All right, let's start with each of you. One takeaway from yesterday's elections, your choice. Mike, we start with you.
Turnout. Turnout was huge. And that was not just here in Pennsylvania. That was all across the country. I think we've seen a level of engagement for the last couple of years that really a lot of people were wondering whether it was going to carry through, and it looks like it did.
Chris Potter.
Yeah. Other than turnout, I'd say to me the surprise was that there weren't more surprises in a way. After 2016, when the polls all proved wrong and it seemed as though all of a sudden Philadelphia and the southeast part of the state, which had dominate sort of statewide politics, statewide elections, was no longer doing that. Everyone, I think, was sort of wondering, is this the new Pennsylvania? What we saw here, I think, last night was a return to a situation where, A, the polling is correct, and B, Philadelphia really does kind of call the tune for the rest of the state in terms of statewide races and congressional and federal contests.
And Dana Brown.
Women, right? Women, they ran and they won. That's the theme of last night for me. They won both federally and as well as state races. So here in Allegheny County, we're going from one woman representing the Allegheny County delegation to, we believe, five at this point. Also in the state of Pennsylvania, we had zero women representing the state down in Washington, D.C. as a part of the congressional delegation. And now it seems that we will have four. So to go from zero to four is fantastic for those of us who care about both descriptive representation and substantive.
And we're going to get into the congressional delegation and whether the redistricting, quote, worked the way it was intended to, the new map, later on in the program. But, Mike, I want to follow up with something you said, turnout. I mean, I know I waited in line 45 minutes. I know people waited. I never wait in line that long. So what is it, do you think, that just energized people? I mean, we have get out the vote efforts all the time, but what worked this time?
I think both sides were just sort of exercised about what's been going on. And that's not, you know, you've had Democrats who have been mobilized from essentially the day or two after Donald Trump won, once the party kind of gathered itself back up together. And that was, manifested most, dramatically the day after the inauguration, when you had a much larger crowd out for the Women's March in Washington, D.C., a crowd, a protest that eclipsed the inauguration. A lot of people were wondering whether that was going to continue to keep going. On the other side, on the Republican side, you've seen a lot of pushback lately. Now, for a while, it seemed like they were on their heels. They were not energized. They were not engaged as much. But over the last couple of months, with the Brett Kavanaugh hearings and with the that was for the U.S. Supreme Court, and with some of this last minute push to kind of demonize immigrants and try to make people really afraid of this caravan that's still 1,000 miles away, you saw this resurgent movement of voters on the Republican side too, which is why this was not a complete washout for Democrats.
I mean, I think too, part of it is that some groups working on the Democratic side were successful in their efforts. There was significantly higher turnout, for example, in the University of Pittsburgh campus. There's a particular polling place there that focuses almost entirely on college students. It tripled its turnout from the previous midterm in 2014. Other areas kind of outside the center of the campus, but still very student heavy, were voting in numbers in line with those of like longtime South Oakland residents or whatever. So you had those folks pick up, and you had big spikes in a lot of the suburban communities, especially the college educated ones that Democrats were really hoping to get. Now, that worked to some extent. There was brushback clearly for the top of the ticket. The sort of Trumpian Scott Wagner did not perform very well, even in a lot of Republican suburbs. But that blue wave, or whatever you want to call it, didn't trickle down to a lot of the statewide races, which is why we still have part of the reason why we still have a Republican dominated legislature.
Dana.
Well, this certainly was an election all about enthusiasm. And thinking back to Mike's remarks, just to echo a little bit, we know that there was a great amount of enthusiasm, yes, coming off of the 2016 election that did actually manifest itself in a little bit of a small blue wave, basically on the backs and leadership, really, of women who came out in those women's marches and identified themselves as candidates and started running, January 2017, essentially. And so we're starting to see some of the consequence of that.
Quick follow-up. How much of that enthusiasm was due to new faces on the ballots, new names?
Right, so much. I mean, so many first-time candidates happened to be Democratic women, and they took out a number of Republican incumbents. That's just not just here within the state, but also seen nationally. And so you see a whole entire new network of activists and organizers surrounding themselves, these first-time candidates. And again, that energy is largely on the Democratic side. But again, we have to remember that while there is this quote-unquote resistance, there is the resistance to the resistance. And so that's why it was not quite this big blue wave that everyone had anticipated, while women did really, really well. And they mostly were Democrats who did really well. But there is still that resistance to the resistance out there.
Quickly, Chris.
Yeah, here in Allegheny County, actually, there were a handful of woman versus woman races for state legislature, and where that happened, Republicans won all of them. So Republicans can play that game as well. And
House District 30, for example.
House District 30, House District 44, House District 40, I think, are the
now
three.
Now remind us who they are. So Lori Mizgorski, won in 30.
Mizgorski beat Betsy Monroe in 30. Natalie Mihalik beat Sharon Guidi in 40. That's like a South Hills, Upper St. Clair district. And then Valerie Gatos, the Republican, beat Michelle Knoll in the 44th district, which is airport area suburbs.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the legislative races specifically. And now joining our conversation on the line from Philadelphia is Holly Otterbein, reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Philly.com. Welcome, Holly.
Thanks for having me.
So as we talk some specific legislative contests, while Democrats took control of the U.S. House from Republicans, Holly, there was no way that was going to happen in the Pennsylvania House, was it?
No. Even the most hopeful Democrats told me that they thought that was impossible. There was basically one Democrat who was working for a super PAC that played in the state that said that he thought it was possible, but that was virtually it. But they believed that they could make gains, particularly in the Philadelphia suburbs, which have been moving to the left in recent years. They've seen a lot of victories in local elections in the suburban counties around Philadelphia. And they also saw Hillary Clinton win in all of the Philadelphia suburbs. So they thought they could make gains in many of those seats where Clinton won and Republican state legislators had held on in 2016. And it looks as if they did. Democrats were claiming, as of the last time that we spoke to them last night, were claiming a 10-seat gain in the state house. And a lot of those victories came from the Philadelphia suburbs.
And considering they were trailing by about 43, I believe, 10 seats is a gain, but not nearly enough to make a huge difference. Is that fair to say, Mike Warshagen?
Yeah, I mean, the Pennsylvania State House is a very leadership-centric body. It's controlled very much by the people at the top. And so the most important vote that you cast, and this is true in most legislatures, the most important vote you cast is often the one for who is going to be your majority leader. And Republicans, you know, they've kept that majority. They'll keep that leadership, which means they're going to keep control of the process. They're going to be able to set the pace, set the legislative agenda in the House. And part of that, part of the reason that Democrats really weren't looking to pick up the House is because they face a couple of structural disadvantages. One of them is just geography, right? Democrats tend to pack into smaller areas. They don't spread out quite as much as Republicans. The other is a deliberate advantage given to Republicans when they drew the map. So last night, what we saw was when the votes were added up, Democratic candidates in the Pennsylvania House actually got about 400,000 more votes across the state than Republicans. They're still going to be at a 108-95 disadvantage come next January.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I would say too, to sort of pick, I think if you listen to Holly, for those of us out here in the West, you kind of realize that literally this election is sort of a tale of two cities, right? I mean, in Philadelphia, yep. You've got this sort of this broader retrenchment, but Pittsburgh, a lot of opportunities got missed last night. There were several open seats here in Allegheny County in particular. Democrats were really only able to pick up one of them, the state Senate 38 seat. But a lot of these, as we said before, a lot of these state House races, they were open, they had been held by Republicans, and they still are now as of today.
Holly, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, speaking to Democrats out here, a lot of them looked at some of the state House seats in the West, where Democrats were holding on even, but Trump had won and thought that they could lose some of them. So, yeah, it was always going to be a tale of two cities as the Pittsburgh area and the Philadelphia area seem to be moving in separate directions politically.
All right, so the Republicans lost their supermajority in the state Senate, but they still have comfortable margins in both chambers. So legislatively, does it really matter that the Democrats made gains? Who wants to tackle that one?
The closer you get to an even division, the more chances you have for the opposition to pick off a couple of these moderate voters who are in districts who are not even moderate voters. Sometimes it's just an issue that you know that somebody on the other side breaks with their party on. And the slimmer that margin can get, the closer the minority party gets to actually having some influence. We saw that with federally with the ACA repeal effort, when they only needed to peel off a couple of Republican senators because the margin was so slim. And this big goal that Republicans had for the better part of a decade fizzled because of two Republican senators. So the House and the Senate in Pennsylvania aren't quite there. It's still a pretty big gap, and Republicans are most definitely in the driver's seat in the legislature.
Dana, then Holly.
It is. I just want to jump in real quick and remind folks that Governor Wolf did indeed win re-election last night, because we haven't talked about that. I know we're talking about the legislature, but thinking about the relationship between the legislature and the executive branch here within the state, that it is possible that by picking up a few of those seats and making some inroads in the state house, that when it comes budget season, come June, we might actually see a budget closer maybe to being on time, and we can all cross our fingers here. But I just think that having a little bit more balance in the state legislature, more reflective of our larger constituency, could actually move those branches closer together on some issues. At least, it's the day after, so I'm always hopeful about bipartisan compromise.
Yeah, and Holly.
Although, I mean, now that it's not an election year, I wonder if we will see budgets not signed again. I think that for Democrats, too, electorally speaking, they saw this year as part of a multi-year process to try to win back the majority, at least in the state house. And so they're hoping to continue to make gains in 2020 in particular.
All right. Chris, a quick update. There have been some close races, and one of the closest in this area was the 38th State Senate, and we seem to now have a final decision.
That's right. So this was Lindsey Williams, Jeremy Schaefer. We mentioned it before. It was very tight last night, just a few hundred votes. With absentee ballots counted in, Lindsey Williams appears to be up by, I think, about 550 votes, somewhere in that ballpark. And Mr. Schaefer did, in fact, concede on social media, which is, I guess, how we do things now on Facebook last night. So that race appears to be settled, although there will be controversy going forward, perhaps. We can talk about that later.
And Holly brought up that Governor Wolf did indeed win a second term last night.
Regardless of who you love, regardless of the religion you profess, regardless of your gender, Pennsylvania has to be a fairer place. And you understood that and you voted for that.
Reactions to what the governor said there, Holly, since you mentioned the governor.
Oh, it actually wasn't me. I don't want to take credit.
All us ladies sound the same, right, Kevin? That's
I'm joking. Oh, man, you got real in a hurry.
I know, I'm sorry. All right, keep it civil.
In the production booth, they're all going, ooh!
A little laughter there for those in the morning drive, right?
All right, Dana.
Have me back on, Kevin, I promise. No, so yeah, I just wanted to remind folks, yes, that Governor Wolf did indeed win re-election handily. So thinking about this blue wave, certainly we were feeling it at the top of the ticket in Pennsylvania. That's all.
All right, Holly, so you get to comment on Governor Wolf's easy victory, but still he has to work with the Republican-controlled legislature.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, I will be interested to see, you know, whether that happens or to what extent that happens. Now that it's not an election year, he really seemed to kind of be more willing to work with Republicans once it inched closer to the election. I think it's fascinating the governor won re-election so easily in a state that President Trump won. It kind of speaks to, in some cases, the limits of Trumpism. It seems like it's somewhat limited just to Trump. Scott Wagner kind of ran this campaign in which he embraced President Trump, and he also, in some ways, mimicked his style and broke the rules like Trump did. And I think that this election showed that, you know, while Wagner thought that the rules were broken for all candidates now, that they were tossed out, they're only really tossed out for one man, President Trump.
All right, so we have just 15 seconds remaining for each of you. So what does this say about Pennsylvania in non-judicial positions? Five of the six statewide office holders are Democrats, and yet we still have Republican-controlled legislature. 15 seconds, Holly.
It's a bright purple state. I heard someone refer to that as it yesterday, and I thought that was a great way to describe it. It's just a bright purple state. And we're going to continue, I think, to see these kind of split verdicts in Pennsylvania.
Mike Wershagen.
Yeah, Holly's dead on there. This is you have to hold several things in your head at once when you're trying to think about Pennsylvania politics. And that's true after every election. It's true after this one, too.
And Dana Brown.
Yes, it's a bright purple state, but our institutions matter. And so thinking about 2020 and redistricting, some of those advantages that Republicans have are purposely built in there in terms of our institutions. So I just want to remind folks that institutions matter.
10 seconds, Chris Potter.
Yeah, I would just say that although Scott Wagner thought he could break a lot of rules, one of the rules he didn't follow was actually campaigning in the parts of the state where Donald Trump did well, and that's what killed him.
Chris Potter is editor of WESA's Politics and Government team, and Dana Brown is executive director of the Center for Women and Politics. Holly Otterbein is reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Mike Wershagen, investigative reporter for the caucus. Thanks to all of you.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
This week in 1895, Andrew Carnegie personally dedicated the main Carnegie Library in Oakland. Throughout his life, Carnegie established thousands of libraries in countries like Britain, Ireland, and Fiji. The Oakland branch is still the hub of the Carnegie Libraries of Pittsburgh, and it now boasts more than 2.5 million items. In total, Carnegie gave away $60 million to fund nearly 1,700 libraries in the U.S. alone. I'm Mick Stinelli for the Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're discussing the impact of Tuesday's election results. And now we turn our attention to the federal contest. Pennsylvania voters chose 18 members of the U.S. House, sent incumbent Democrat Bob Casey back to the Senate for a third term. And joining us now in studio is Brenton Mock, writer-reporter for City Lab. Welcome, Brenton. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And remaining in studio with us, Dana Brown, executive director of the Center for Women and Politics at Chatham University, and Chris Potter, WESA's political editor. So Republicans still have the edge in the Pennsylvania congressional delegation. There were some Pennsylvania congressional delegation, but they did flip the Democrats some seats of the 18. So do we have a sense that the state Supreme Court redrawn congressional district map did its job? Were the Democratic candidates more appealing this time around? Did they campaign better? Lots of questions there. Chris Potter, we're going to start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question but that redistricting was a big factor in what happened here last night, right? I think actually they're evenly split now. It's 9-9, Democrats and Republicans. This time a year ago, I think it was 13-5. So Connor Lamb bit into that a little bit earlier this year. But so now we're evenly split. And, you know, Connor Lamb won last night because he was drawn into a district with Keith Rothfuss, a fellow incumbent House member. But a lot of these that district was drawn with a slight Republican edge. But this was a good year to be a Democrat in many ways. So he won. A lot of these other races were competitive. And I think you have to say, as we were saying just at the end of the first segment, this is a purple state, and we now have a congressional delegation that sort of fits that. And a lot of other states didn't have that kind of gain, and I think it's because they may still be using districts that don't really reflect where people are at.
Brenton Mock.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Supreme Court ruling and the redrawing, it did what it was supposed to do, and brought a little bit better equity and parity to our congressional delegation. Could probably still do a little bit better, but, you know, not to take anything away from Lamb's campaigning, he did what he was supposed to do to get a district in neighborhoods that, quite frankly, have gone to Republicans in the past, and a lot of whom voted for Trump in the past election. So it was a win-win on both sides.
And Dana Brown.
Yeah, and certainly thinking about the redistricting impact that it had on our congressional delegation. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. I mean, Pennsylvania has not had a woman go to the U.S. Congress on behalf of the Commonwealth since 2014, when Alison Schwartz last was in that seat out in Philadelphia. And so we've been sending zero women, and now we have four, in part because of a couple of open seat contests. So we certainly see a gender diversity in our government now as a positive consequence of that redistricting effort.
Well, we're still waiting for a final number, more than 90 women were elected to the U.S. House yesterday, including the four that you mentioned, Dana, including Mary Gay Scanlon.
They've risen to the occasion in order to protest and push back against the worst impulses of this administration.
All right. Pushback. Comment on what Mary Gay Scanlon said?
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly that is true in the districts where Democrats advanced out in the Philadelphia area. We were saying this before, that Donald Trump, that his approach to politics, his substantive, his policies, they don't play well amongst college-educated suburbanites in particular. There are a lot of those folks out in the Philadelphia collar counties, Delaware and Chester, those counties right around there. And that kind of tells the tale. And it's also part of the reason why we didn't see more gains. I mean, Western Pennsylvania was essentially a push for congressional Democrats. Yeah, Connor Lamb won this seat, but he vacated one that was won by Guy Reschenthaler, a Republican. So status quo out here in the West, all that change was in the East.
Well, hold on. It wasn't really a push, because before the whole Tim Murphy thing in the Southwest corner, it was two Republicans, sure, and one Democrat. So no.
Fair enough. Yeah, depending, yeah, on your time frame. Okay. Yeah, if we go a, right, year ago, yes. But, yeah, if we go, nothing changed last night from the day before in,
true,
terms of Western Pennsylvania's delegation. But you're,
true,
right.
Dana Brown. On the women, and in one case, it was in the eastern part of the state, two women running, Democrat versus Republican. So how enthusiastic are you about that?
Right. So we knew going into the night that Mary Gay Scanlon versus Pearl Kim, we were going to have a woman regardless at the end of the night, that we're going to have representation there. We're certainly excited at the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics because, Pearl Kim actually was an alum of our Ready to Run campaign training. And Chrissy Houlihan, who was a successful congressional candidate, is indeed a Ready to Run alum as well from our center. So we're very excited to have that first Ready to Run alum from our educational program go to D.C. We're very excited.
All right. Joining us on the line now is reporter Laura Olson from The Morning Call. Welcome, Laura. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Laura, we're talking about the victories by women both in Pennsylvania and nationwide. So can you give us sort of the larger implication, Pennsylvania's place in what happened last night across the country?
Sure. So the Democratic pickups that we saw in the state's congressional delegation played a key part in the House flipping to the Democratic Party. So we're gonna see some lawmakers who had been in the majority now finding themselves in a new role when it comes to our Republican lawmakers who will be returning. And those pickups were definitely part of the plan for national Democrats as they were seeking to retake the House.
And for retaking the House involved a lot of women victors last night nationally.
Absolutely. So we had four in this part of the state, and the last numbers I saw is that we're going to be somewhere north of 100 female lawmakers in the U.S. House nationally. Right now, it had been 84. So that's a pretty big change. I'm not quite sure what the final total is going to be, but Pennsylvania played a significant role in increasing those numbers as well.
Dana.
I just want to jump in here and remind folks that while we're excited about the candidates and those that were victorious, thinking about the makeup of the U.S. House, because it is driven by Democratic women, that also means that we're going to have Democratic women in leadership positions. So I know, you know, Speaker Pelosi, it's quite possible we'll have another Speaker Pelosi, but it's beyond that. We know that we have more women elected on the Democratic side, which means chairmanships and so on. So we're going to have women leadership within the U.S. House at a much higher rate than we did previously in the Republican Congress.
And Laura, I want to, since you cover Washington, you cover Congress in Washington, the power of those chairs is very important as opposed to the ranking minority member.
Absolutely. And we saw Pennsylvania's delegation is going to have seven new freshman lawmakers. And so there, it's really a changing of the guard. We had a number of retirements this year from folks like Congressman Bill Schuster, who had been leading the Transportation Committee. That's a pretty significant committee that handles a lot of money that goes to repair roads and bridges, which is a pretty significant priority for Pennsylvania. And we had in our neck of the woods, Republican Charlie Dent, who played a very senior role on the House Appropriations Committee. So as those lawmakers are exiting, we'll see some new folks who get to move up the ranks.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ironies here is this was a selling point for Republicans, don't, you know, to their own base. Don't let these Democrats, you know, take over. I must have heard Keith Rothfuss maybe a half dozen times say, don't let Maxine, I'm on the Financial Services Committee, don't let Maxine Waters be the chair of that committee. And I guess one result of last night is he won't have to worry about that. The flip side, I think, is that for Connor Lamb, it'll be interesting to see how he kind of reacts to being in a majority. I think one of the things we've sort of seen here is the solidification of this kind of almost myth of this guy. I mean, I was hearing people talk about him in the same terms they used to discuss John Hines. John Hines of the Democratic Party, young and charismatic and moderate and personable, you know, sort of seen as a rising star. And it will be interesting to see how he sort of handles being in the majority, which can be a dicier proposition than being in the minority party.
Brenton.
Yeah, I mean, and you heard Republicans saying, don't let these Democrats take over. I think I heard the subtweet of, don't let these women take over. And, you know, beyond just, I mean, it's great that there's going to be a lot of women chairs on the committees and subcommittees, but I'm also excited about, you know, the possibility of just more diverse representation in the committees and subcommittees themselves. Beyond that, more of a diversity, even amongst the women who are elected, if you have your first Muslim woman in the House, you have a Palestinian in the House, you have a Native American queer women in the House.
I mean,
there's just a lot. Yeah, there's just a lot of great diversity, even within the gender diversity that we're seeing. And you know, they're standing on the shoulders of people, obviously, like Maxine Waters and Nancy Pelosi. But, you know, couldn't help but see when Nancy Pelosi was addressing the crowd last night, just kind of how, you know, forgive me, kind of old the Democratic leadership looked like up there. I mean, they kind of look like the staff from the cast from Cocoon up there. But like,
Why are you asking us to forgive you for that, Brent? That's what I want to
know. I'm only saying because there are a lot of young women who are coming in, and I can't wait for the day when I can see like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being the person who's addressing this crowd.
So, we're discussing the impact of yesterday's election. We're going to talk about campaign messaging, what worked, maybe what didn't work, when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Connor Lamb, who won a special election 8 months ago, is headed to the U.S. House for a full two-year term after defeating Republican incumbent Keith Rothfuss last night, and Senator Bob Casey easily won a third term.
We will protect what you've earned. We will protect your health and protect your pension. We will protect your children's future. And we will find a way to do all of that while protecting this planet.
We have to continue that fight. Have to continue the fight against any attempt by politicians in Washington to either rip away coverage or to deny people protections. We are not going back.
All right, so both Congressman Connor Lamb, whose voice we heard first, and Senator Casey, who we just heard there, both mentioned health care. Laura, I want to start with you on this. Was healthcare sort of a unifying message for Democrats, either in Pennsylvania or even across the nation? Was that a common thread?
Absolutely. We heard a lot about health care. And one of the ways we saw it play out both in the U.S. Senate race and in the Lehigh Valley congressional race, where I was following pretty closely, was the focus on pre-existing conditions. So we heard Democrats repeatedly here and across the country saying, you know what, these Republicans have either supported repealing Obamacare entirely or have voted to repeal Obamacare entirely. And doing that would remove the protections that that law put in place for folks who need coverage but have pre-existing conditions. Make sure that they aren't discriminated against. And we found that the Republicans were then on the defensive, having to say, no, I think that's a great provision. I don't like Obamacare, but that provision, that's great. We're going to protect it.
Yeah, and I mean, the Republican messaging on this was kind of disastrous. In the Ron DiNicola, Mike Kelly race, Mike Kelly, the Republican incumbent, won that race, but it was close, a lot closer than I think a lot of people would have guessed 6 months ago. And
remind us, Chris, that's 16?
That is the 16th district from Butler County up north to Erie.
Okay.
And, you know, Mike Kelly, you know, Ron DiNicola, the Democrat, challenged Kelly on his votes for repeal. And Kelly was like, the Washington Post said that's a four Pinocchio attack. She said it was the New York Post, which is the wrong newspaper. And second of all, totally mischaracterized the Washington Post position. The Washington Post position was Republicans did take votes by doing that to weaken pre-existing protections for people with pre-existing conditions. So he ends up sort of obfuscating about an attempt to obfuscate on what was going on here. And Republicans just never recovered from that. And I don't think they ever really found. You know, I think they tried the tax cut message when Connor Lamb's special election earlier this spring. It obviously didn't work for them, and it just wasn't salient for these guys. Keith Raffis tried to use it a little bit. They never had anything that they could kind of sink a stake into and hold on to during this election.
Dana.
Yeah, it did appear that the Republicans really were kind of on their heels this election cycle in terms of health care, and the Democrats, in a very unifying message, discussing the Affordable Care Act and all of its positives that people really are now quite comfortable with and expectant. And there was this, you know, kind of intersection of gender and some of those domestic policy issues where we kind of stereotypically expect women candidates to do better on those issues. And so if you are messaging that out, that obviously could resonate in much greater level with voters.
Brenton?
Yeah, I think the healthcare message definitely resonated with legacy voters. But I think we also saw like a huge aggressive push among civil rights and voting rights organizations to get more younger people, more people of color, African Americans out to vote. And they weren't using healthcare as a message. It was more like, look, this is Trump. Like
was an anti-vote.
I think the further down you go to low income people of color and younger people, people who are perhaps not as much materially benefiting from healthcare reforms, I think that the message of just, look, we really have to put more balances and checks on the Trump administration was the message that got them out.
So for the successful Republican congressional candidates in Pennsylvania, was there, Laura, a particular message that resonated, whether it was the economy's doing well or immigration or what have you, or was it just sheer numbers of voter registration in terms of a Republican advantage? What do you think?
I think one thing that was interesting is we saw some pretty close races. I know Krista mentioned Mike Kelly's race up in Erie, down in South Central Pennsylvania. We saw Scott Perry very, very narrowly holding on to his seat. And so I think it varied a lot district to district depending on the makeup, because even though these districts generally had become more Democratic leaning, there were some that were still pretty like ruby red, and there were others where it was a much closer race.
I wanted to ask you about suburban voters, how they do. And I know, Brenton, you've been keeping an eye on, been interested in the role of suburban voters. What's your takeaway on that, whatever it is, the congressional or state legislative races?
Yeah, I mean, I think the conventional wisdom going into, you know, from now into the future is that demography is destiny for politics. But what we found in analysis at City Lab is that also density is destiny as well. That's a lot to say. Density is destiny. Yeah, like as suburbs are becoming more dense and they're becoming more diverse, those districts that represent those suburbs are becoming more competitive, and particularly opening up paths for Democrats to finally come in and break waves in there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've seen here this year is that sort of the closer in you, and this is also sort of density, the closer you are to a city, the more likely you are to be Democratic. So Mount Lebanon, for example, for a very long time was Republican-leaning. In the past few cycles, it's now pretty solidly Democratic, and it came out big for Connor Lamb, who's from that community himself. You get a little further out, though. The further out you go, you get to Elizabeth Township, for example. Republican won that race, state legislative race, the 39th district, formerly held by Rick Saccone. A Republican won that race pretty handily, even though the Democrat, Rob Roderick, had backing from a lot of Republicans and was a fairly well-known guy. So there is very much this cleavage here about destiny and distance. Not all suburbs are the same. We sometimes talk about them that way,
right.
But they're kind of more working-class suburbs. They're college-educated suburbs versus just sort of ex-urban areas. It's a much more varied picture than people want to say.
Dana, I want to ask you: Will your people sort of look at the results of and break it down to the suburbs and see what might have played there? For instance, we didn't mention earlier when we were talking about the successful women candidates for Congress that Bibiana Borio lost to Republican Guy Reschenthaler in the newly drawn 14th, which is heavily Republican registered. But do you look at that and see what trends are there? Like Brenton said, you know, the diversification of suburbs.
Right. I mean, we're certainly going to be very interested in suburbs in different ways. Mm-hmm. People are talking a lot about the collar counties in particular and how particularly white usually Republican voters, did they actually come home to the Republican Party? Did they stay home that day? And then similarly with the working class vote, how did that break? So we are definitely going to, in a couple days, probably start to disaggregate the data. But I just want to echo about like enthusiasm in different ways. While healthcare was a primary issue, looking at the exit polling data, we know that like 4 out of 5 voters were really enthusiastic actually about Trump in a negative way, right? They were enthusiastic to push against him. And so that's what we start to see, a diversity of reasons, not just these issues, but yeah, this general reaction to the national tenor that he himself is setting for folks.
All right. We have just 2 minutes left. So I want please quick answers. I'll start with you, Laura. So where do we go from here? We have a divided government in Washington, which you cover, Republican administration and Senate, a Democratic House. What's that going to mean for the country going ahead and maybe even for Pennsylvania? Laura, briefly, please.
So I think we'll hear a little bit more about that this morning when President Trump has a news conference, and we'll see the tone he takes. Is he willing to reach out and talk with Democrats? Are some of these Democrats going to get a phone call from him and say, hey, let's make a deal, let's work on things like infrastructure, or do we start off with a more combative tone? So we'll find out where that goes.
Brenton Mock.
My expectations aren't high. I know that Democrats took back the House. It's going to stop some bleeding. But, you know, I envision more government shutdowns, Trump blaming those on Democrats being obstructionists and so on and so forth. I'm more excited about the trickling up of the excitement amongst young and diverse leaders coming up through the ranks, people like Summer Lee and Sarah Innamorato, you know, winning at the state legislative level and hopefully, you know, moving up, keep going forward with more and more diverse leaders like that.
All right. Chris Potter, briefly.
Yeah, I just don't know what Donald Trump says today, whether it will hold true for 10 minutes after he's done saying it. I mean, that's the thing with him, right? So I don't know. I tend to agree with Brent that we were going to be in for a bumpy ride anyway. But it's now going to be sort of a more cross-partisan kind of thing. At the state legislature, we'll see. You know, a lot of seats lost from the Philadelphia area, and that will change the way Republicans think and act within their caucuses, I suspect.
All right. About 20 seconds, Dana Brown.
Yeah, thinking about the U.S. House, I mean, we certainly are up for a big collision. Finally, we're going to have potentially some oversight of the executive branch now that we have the U.S. House going Democrat. Certainly, for those of us who are political scientists and care about Article 1 of the Constitution, we want to make sure that they actually are exercising their authority to oversee the executive branch. And that, unfortunately, has not really materialized yet, and we might start to see that happen now.
All right. Dana Brown is Executive Director of the Center for Women and Politics at Chatham University. Laura Olson is Capitol Reporter for The Morning Call. And Brenton Mock is a writer-reporter for City Lab. And, of course, our own Chris Potter, WESA's Politics and Government Accountability Editor. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Nick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.